Accession number 28699, reel 12.
So cigarettes could basically get you anything.
That's right.
Mr. Casey, reel 12. So cigarettes could basically get you anything.
That's right. The officers were protected in the sense that we were always taken in a jeep to the officers' club or whatever, where we got tight, ate and got tight, and then were taken back in the jeep. And military police were always round these places. But the other ranks didn't have this kind of protection. So two things. One, a woman was 10 cigarettes for the night. And the other thing, there was a lot of VD. In fact, I remember there was a song going round about Sentimental Journey. I remember one of my NCOs got VD, and I walked in and I said, "Where's Sergeant so-and-so?" And the others lined up like they used to do in the films and said, "He's gonna take a sentimental journey." And that meant he'd be 48 hours on the penicillin or whatever. So there was a lot, but as I say, officers were protected because they just went out, got tight, and were brought back. There were a lot of fellas had incredible liaisons. I mean, one of them, my men, private, had a mistress who was like a film star. She was fantastic, you know. And he was the most unattractive bloke. But that sort of thing went on. And we had, as I say, problems with the Russians. Americans were fine. And so in Berlin, we really did kind of patrols at night and things like that, and training. But mostly it was enjoying yourself. It was, you know, playing squash, doing whatever, going out every night. Sundays, we used to go out and get tight at lunchtime. There wasn't an officer who'd had half his stomach shot away. He'd been a regimental sergeant major in the paratroops. Fantastic bloke. And he used to get tight at lunchtime. And he couldn't come round, so he never went out in the evening. He used to be furious, but he was always too tight to go out. And he had a lovely cockney wit, broad cockney he was. And see, I left the Durhams in Berlin and was transferred to the Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, who took over from us in Berlin. So I stayed, instead of 2 or 3 months, I was there for 6 months.
That was when the 9th moved out and these people came in.
And they came in, and I was transferred to them and made a company commander as a captain, not as a major. And Peter Thompson and I and two or three others, there were four of us really, and we had been in Berlin, so we were familiar with all these, the clubs, the three clubs and brigade headquarters and that. And when the others came, there'd be an invitation for three officers to go to brigade headquarters. Well, we used to go on our own because we knew them all, see. So we went to all of them. We didn't just go when requested. In fact, I wrote a song that we used to sing. It was when we used to say, you've lost your eyes. The next morning, it'd say, "Where did you lose your eyes last night?" You know. And I had this thing about we lost our eyes in three places. The embassy, blue, white and brigade. And we've been on thousands of wild goose chases at the embassy, the blue, white and brigade. We're followed by pink elephants who wear straw hats and spats, and butterflies with clogs on dance all day long inside our hats. And then the second bit was, because I was a bit aggressive as a boxer when I got tight, especially if I got tight on whiskey and Capstick and George and Peter Thompson. It was Jim will fight Joe Louis. Peter dies each night because he drank more than anybody. Capstick is without a clue, and George don't sleep without a light. And we lost our eyes, and then it was four places. The Embassy, Blue White, First Tanks and Brigade. And then, when they moved out of Berlin, Peter and I were moved because the colonel who'd asked for us, and was a nice fella, he'd gone to England on a long course, and the second in command didn't like us. And I'd had a bit of a go because they made me transport officer. And they'd had people over who had examined it and said they were sending inspectors out from England in 2 months' time or whatever. And if the transport wasn't better, there'd be trouble. So he took the transport officer off and made me transport officer. And then a couple of days later, when everybody used to just do maintenance in the morning, we were told to pick up some new vehicles, you see. So I sent off 20 of the blokes. And the adjutant turns up and starts checking. And he said, "What are you doing? Where's all of the men?" I said, "Well, it was such a rotten day." I said, I told them they could just have a lie in. And, what do you think? I said, "Oh, shut up." I said, "I've sent them to collect new vehicles." And I went to see the colonel. And I said, "Look, you've given me this job, colonel. I don't want it, but you're giving it to me. And when they come in 2 months' time, if there's something wrong, I'll accept it, the trouble. But not now. And I do not want the adjutant coming to see if I'm doing my job. If that's the way you think, you can find somebody else and let me do some other job." Anyway, so we didn't get on. He decided we were going to be transferred. So I said, "Well, I want to go back to the Durhams to be demobbed," which was happened about 8 weeks later, you see. So we were both sent to the Durhams, me and Peter Thompson. And as we were getting in the jeeps, the colonel arrived back from England and asked what was going on. And when we told him, he said, "How dare he? How dare he?" I said, "Look, I want to go, colonel. I want to go back to the Durhams and finish there." And Peter was going to be a regular. So he came back to the West Lancs, to the Oxen Bucks. After a couple of days, he came back. But I stayed in the Durhams and stayed there till I was demobbed.
And what was the demob process?
Well, all I can remember is you went to some place and signed things, and they gave you a suit and clothes, and I think you got an extra bit of money. And I didn't want to know about anything. I just wanted to get out and get home. In fact, I didn't send off the thing for my medals, which I'm trying to get now. I've been trying since July, because I didn't. I said, "I don't want medals. I want to get home and forget it." But Peter stayed on as a regular. And I just...
What date were you demobbed? What was the date?
Oh, no, it was October. October 46. Yes, October 46.
So he came home, and what did you do immediately? You got back into Civvy Street.
Well, immediately, I spent about a month trying to be a bookmaker. Well, at least my uncle was taking bets for me at the thing. It was a total disaster. So then my father said he wanted me to come with him as his manager, and my mother said, "Yes, try and stop him gambling." So that was for the next, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. My job was trying to stop my father gambling, losing all his money, which I couldn't do. And then I started writing for him for broadcasts. And then I started writing shows for him, half-hour shows. That's how I got into the writing. And then started writing with other people then. Norman Evans was the first one, Over the Garden Wall, a radio show. And then I wrote for lots and lots of other comics. And then my father, one of his stooges, the first thing was, he had to go and do truth shows. So he asked me to come. And I was supposed to go there and write script. But when I got there, this German organizer came up.
And this was over in Germany?
Yeah. For British troops. And he said, we've made a mistake, Mr. James. He said, because we open with five girl dancers, and then you'll have to go on because we should have booked another comedian. And you're doing two acts, but you'll have to go on and talk to the audience. So my father said, oh, that's all right, Jim will do it. Well, consider I'd never spoken to an audience in my life. I was a bit shattered. And he said, all he wants to do is 5 minutes. Don't make a big thing out of it. And I knew how to go on. So in the end, I said, well, I'll compare the show. And then I can do a gag and introduce an act. Well, he said, do whatever you like. He said, you know, don't make a production out of it. He just wants you to. So I walk on. And the weather was terrible, icy. And there's five girls gone. They come off, and I walk on. And the troops, all the get off and bring the women back, you see. I said afterwards, I said, they were giving me the burden. They didn't know I was bad. Because, and I thought, I've got to say something that's a little bit near for those days that'll stop them. So I suddenly thought of this. I said, I'm sorry about my cough. I said, because we'd just come back from Hamburg and it was 30 degrees below there. I said, well, you can tell. When we stopped at the garage, there was a welder doing a fitter doing a welding job on a brass monkey. And it was a big roar. And they shut up. And I carried on. And then I introduced the next act and so on. I mean, before I went on, I'd thrown up twice in the dressing room with nerves. And then the ventriloquist, and he said to me, have you ever played Attercliffe? I said, I've never played anywhere. That was it tonight. He said, well, that was terrific. I couldn't do that. And my father came up, and he said, hello to Fred. And he said, you know that gag you did about the beer? I said, yes. He said, you ruined it. I said, you could be certified insane. You realise that? I said, it's a miracle that I went on. And you, oh, well, he said, if you don't want to do it properly, forget it, and walked away.
And then you kind of got involved with this for some time, didn't you, after that?
Well, I was still writing. Yeah. And then a stooge left and he said, well, you'll have to come in the act for a couple of weeks. Well, I was in for nearly 3 years. And I wrote for him in that time when he did a broadcast like Works Playtime, Music Hall or something. And I used to write the script and I used to feed him with the stooge. But I changed it so that I was straight man rather than two stooges. So I'd be the doctor, I'd be whatever, you know, in the script. And then I decided I want to concentrate on writing scripts. So I left him after Southport. We'd been at Southport for 6 weeks. And I started just writing. And then about 8 months later, the man who was the head of Light Entertainment in Manchester said, there's a vacancy for producer. Will you apply for it? So I said to my wife, well, I'll do it. They won't have me because they've got 8 people on the shortlist who've all been in the BBC, studio managing thing. Anyway, to my surprise, they said, I'd wrote and told me I'd got the job. And I said to my wife, well, we've got to decide whether I want to do it now. I mean, the money's terrible.
So who did you finish up writing for? There's quite a number of very famous
entertainers. Oh, yes, yes, yes. What I liked, and I thought it was important, was to write the first half-hour show for somebody. Because up till then, they'd done broadcasts and things, but they hadn't worked out what they should do for a whole half hour. So I wrote Ken Dodd's first half hour show, I produced it, and then I did three series with him, but I wrote and produced his first, and I did the same with Les Dawson, with Hilda Baker. I wrote for Jewel and Morris, Morecambe and Wise. David Morris I wrote a lot for. Really, all the Northern comics, because they used to have a series called Northern Variety Parade, which was a different show each week, but they came back about every 4 or 5 weeks. And this is why I actually left my father, because I got onto that, and I was writing a show for him. I was writing one for Norman Evans, and I was working in my father's act. So I spent all day writing and then working in the theatre at night. And I said, this is no good, you know. So I switched, and then Ronnie Taylor was the boss man then in Manchester, and he got me writing all these other shows. But as I say, to me the important thing was to do the first one. I mean, I can remember Ken Dodd's reaction. I'd written a script for him before, for ordinary broadcasts, you know, music hall and things. And then I wrote this half-hour show. And we did it, and it really went great, terrific. And afterwards, we were having a drink, and I can see him now standing there with his overcoat and his hat, the trilby on, and he took his hat off and he said, well, I didn't think there was a laugh in this, that show. Which just goes to show how much more you know about radio than I do. Mind, the stage, I know. But radio, you know. And that established our relationship, which went on for 20-odd years, you know.
And you produced shows as well?
Oh, yes. I produced all the ones I wrote, and then I produced lots I didn't write. Like, for instance, Jimmy Tarr book. I did Roy Castle for 11 years, his radio series, Jimmy Tarbuck series, the great ventriloquist, Mike Yarwood, did his series, and Les Dawson, of course, and eventually it took me 5 years to get them to accept Les on national radio. I'd done Northern Radio, I'd done individual broadcasts, and after 5 years, they finally accepted a situation comedy I wrote called Our Les. And then we changed that after a couple of years to Listen to Les, which is more sketches and patter, and that ran for another 10, 11 years, till after I'd retired. Eddie Braben, I did series with him for about 9 years. Jimmy Clitheroe, of course, was the longest. That ran for 14 years. And I co-wrote that. Most of the writing, but not all of it. But with Les. Well, Les put some stuff in the opening. He used to, you know, nobody could write stand-up patter for him like he could.
This is Les Dawson.
Yeah, the first time I'd written a 3-minute opening, and he did 5, none of which was mine. And I said, well, what am I wasting my time for? It took me a day to write that. And, you know, so I'd leave a blank and say, opening, patter.
We're obviously at the end of the story almost now. What were the best times or moments in your army life? What were the good moments or moments?
I suppose it's strange, really, because some of the bad times were marvellous times as well. I mean, I told you about how I was stood there laughing when Pierre Jordan came out with his line about Sal Resurrectum, and with Peter Thompson and George and Cappy, We had some wonderful times.
It's a comradeship in that sense.
Oh, tremendous. See, I'd started off going into the tanks and to avoid the infantry, really. And then when I was transferred, I hated the thought. But later on, I would never have changed. Because in the infantry, there is such a close comradeship. Everybody is for everybody because you're in the lousiest situation. And you had this terrific pride in being in the infantry. I mean, a bit silly in a way, but you had this feeling that other people weren't in the war because they were 2 miles back. What do they know about war? You know, I mean, it's daft. But that's the feeling you had, and there was this terrific comradeship that you were in the infantry and you were the fighters, and you know, you had this incredible feeling. I mean, we used to watch planes go over, and we didn't say, you know, brave lads. You say, look at those so-and-sos. They'd be going back home tonight, sleeping in a bed with clean sheets, and probably a woman. And here we are in a bloody slit trench. So, at the time, you hated them, because they weren't having a rough time. It wasn't so much the danger as the conditions, you know. And you had these moments, really. I can remember we were in slit trenches and there was some houses nearby. And a batman had gone and come back. And he spread a lace tablecloth across the top of the slit trench. Some crystal glasses and a bottle of wine. you know, that been left in the house. And those kind of things, moments like that. And the exhilaration when you did something, when you got somewhere and you won the fight. Somehow, I think when you don't remember things, I think it's because you deliberately didn't remember people's names and things, because somebody was killed, that had to go, that had, because there's somebody else now, and you've got another place to go to. So only certain individuals would you really feel strongly about or be very upset. People being killed became commonplace, and only if it was a real friend, like one of my pals was killed the night before Longeveu, and that really hit me, you know, because I blamed myself because he'd gone from the switch over to infantry and he joined me because I said, I'm going to the Durhams. He said, well, I'll come with you. And I mean, he wasn't from the north. Don Laycock, he was called. And so I thought, it's my fault he was killed. He wouldn't have been here if it hadn't been for me. That only lasted a few moments, really, because you got on with the next thing,